All right, the second lecture this afternoon is titled Light, Line, and Worship Through Transformation of the Everyday. And again, the focus of this second lecture is going to be on Henri Matisse and his Chapel of the Rosary. Now, a little bit about how the first lecture connects to the second. Again, in the first lecture that we just finished, the focus there was on a very specific painting, and the painting was Grunewald's Crucifixion. And so as we transition from Grunewald's painting to Matisse, first of all, we're going to be transferring, I guess, from more of a traditional worship setting to what is often regarded as one of the most, even today, cutting-edge worship settings within the modern context. In making the transition, we could say that we literally are transitioning from darkness to light. Physically speaking, you're going from a work of art where you're using dark colors, there's dark earthy hues, and so there's a certain blackness that is there. And as we shift to Matisse, for Matisse, one of the most important elements for him is light. I mean, light is what essentially makes his place what it is. And so we have that interesting transition. A second transition is that we move from a context where we have Grunewald's painting, which is designed for a place, ultimately, of lamentation. It's designed for a place where you have physical pain and distress. That if you were to go into that church and to look upon this painting, again, the atmosphere is going to be filled with cries and tears, and it's a very active, very loud place. When you move into the chapel, you move into, again, almost the complete opposite. This is a place that is defined by silence. It's designed to be a place where you can go into and you can reflect, you can think, but there is a certain quietness that is attached to it. So again, this is a very, very different context. And then the last major transition, again, is we're moving from a single painting to now an entire sacred space. And so we're greatly broadening our perspective. Now, like many of the artists that we talked about in the first lecture, Matisse was also deeply influenced by Grunewald's Crucifixion painting. We know that Matisse was aware of the painting. We knew that he studied it very carefully, and that as Matisse was sketching out designs for some of the images in his chapel, we know through himself that he used Mary's hands as a source of inspiration. And so here we have, for purposes of the lecture, a direct connection between Grunewald's Crucifixion and what Matisse is going to try to do with his chapel. In the same way that I began the last lecture, by looking at this question of significance, I'd like to do the same thing here. I mean, in other words, why of all places would I choose the Chapel of the Rosary as a place to speak about? So a little bit about the significance of this place. Well, the first thing we could say is that the Chapel of the Rosary is one of the earliest and finest examples of the integration of modern art and the church. In fact, when the chapel was created, I mean, you would often hear terms thrown around like revolutionary, that this is unlike anything we had ever seen before. And part of what made it not only revolutionary but very controversial is that you have a sacred space that not only is seeking to include a single work of modern art into it, but the entire chapel is completely designed to be modern. And so while you have these early debates that are waging back and forth within the church with regards to modern art, do we accept it? Do we get rid of it? What do we make of it? Is modern art a reflection of the degeneration in our society. What do we do with it? And here's Matisse who says, well, I'm going to create a sacred space and I'm going to put modern art at the heart of it. And so for that reason, it is one of the best examples that we have of this attempt to bring the modern into worship. Another major significance of this piece is that the entire chapel was completely designed and decorated by, at the time, one of the most influential artists of the modern period. When you look at this chapel, again, it's not simply that Matisse designed the ceramic line drawing or that he designed the stained glass windows. He designed every single object in the chapel, down to the candlesticks were designed by him. There's nothing that you see in that picture that he did not create. And so not only do you have this very well-known, important artist in the modern period who is going to attempt to create this modern worship structure, but he's doing it all. And some have said that this chapel represents one of the few times in all of art history where you have a single artist who literally designs a complete worship space. Everything in there is from him. This is his artistic vision. And then lastly, one of the significance of this chapel actually comes from Matisse himself. And this is a pretty bold statement. Again, you consider Henri Matisse. He has, by the time he creates this chapel, he's produced a lifetime's worth of work. He has gained for himself a reputation. He's seen as being one of the most influential, one of the masters. He's commissioning works. He's making good money off of what he's doing. But when Matisse himself looks at this, he says, of everything I've ever done, this is my masterpiece. This is what I deem the best. In a statement that Matisse made with regards to this chapel, he writes, "This work has taken me 4 years of exclusive and assiduous work, and it represents the result, key idea, of my entire active life. I consider it, in spite of its imperfections, to be my masterpiece." So again, this is a rather significant statement coming from the artist himself. It's not that, I thought this was okay, but this is my best. And so, again, because of this, we somewhat see the importance as to why we would focus upon it. Now, in the same way as in the first lecture when we were talking about Grunewald's crucifixion, that when you talk about it, it's like putting together a big puzzle where you have all these different pieces, and it's only in putting the pieces together that the larger picture begins to unfold. The same thing can be said of Matisse's chapel. And so what I would like to do to begin is to spend just a few moments and giving you a little bit of a background about Matisse, about who he was. We know, for example, that he was a French painter, sculptor, graphic artist, and designer. From the 1920s, again, he was regarded as one of the foremost painters of his time. So again, he's an individual who established his reputation early and became a major driving force in modern art. He became famous in large measure for two things. The first was known as his sensitive use of line. This idea of going back to the single line and using almost contour-type drawings to express ideas and images. So here again is an example of an untitled piece of his. And at the same time, in addition to his use of line, he was perhaps even more well known for his bold use of color. Matisse, to look at some of the paintings of Matisse, what initially just drives you and hits you isn't so much the quality of the drawings in terms of what they represent, but it's this in-your-face color. Color is everything to him. And so here's one of his best examples, the large red interior, again, that just hits this color to the hilt. One of his central subjects that he focused on was the human figure. And following two operations from cancer, in 1941, he was confined to a bed or a wheelchair for the rest of his life. When he creates the chapel, he will be in this condition. And so because of that, if you begin to look at various books on this chapel, what you'll notice is that most of the times that you see Matisse, he's always sitting down, or else he's actually in his wheelchair painting away as he would go. However, it was during this time again, from 1949 to 1951, while he was in that state, that he created, in his own words, his masterpiece, or this chapel of the Rosary. And then a few years after Matisse completed the chapel, he died on November 3rd, 1954. So in many ways, I mean, the chapel really does represent the last major part of his life. And so in that sense, it really does summarize much of what he was aiming for. So with this background in mind, I now want to move on and kind of unravel a little bit the story behind the chapel. Again, I think the story of the chapel itself, how it came into being, is almost as interesting as the chapel itself. Because this was a very controversial move by Matisse to do this. And the story starts in a very odd place. And so we know, for example, in the early 1940s, Matisse, this was after he was having surgery for cancer, he was in need of a nurse. And so he placed an ad at a local nursing school. So Matisse comes out of surgery, and he's essentially at a state where he needs someone to come in and literally care for basic needs such as changing his dressing, from making food for him, I mean, helping him to eat. So he's looking for essentially a caretaker to come in and be with him. The ad was answered by a woman by the name of Jacques Marie. Two interesting things to note about Jacques Marie. The first, when she responded to the ad for a nurse, she herself was not yet a nurse. So she was not technically qualified to do the work, but a woman at the nursing school essentially encouraged her to do it. And so she went to Matisse, and she applied for the job to be a nurse, and she got it. Now, at the time, she had no idea who Matisse was. She never heard of him. She didn't know he was an artist. So she did not know, again, that she was going to answer an ad for one of the most important figures in modern art. So she came in rather ignorant, and her ignorance came through in various funny episodes when she actually saw his work, and she was not afraid to tell him what she thought of it. And so there is a whole dialogue between the two. I mean, that's very comical to read. But Matisse loved her honesty, and made a comment at one point that when she would say it like it is, he would say, "You're right. I think you're exactly right." And in fact, you know, what bugs me is when people come in and say, "Oh, Matisse, you're so wonderful, you're so great, oh, I love your work," when deep down inside, I mean, they would just rip it up if they could. But she just shot straight to the point and would tell me to my face what she thought of it. So right from the beginning, again, this very interesting relationship. Because he was very sick, she had, among other things, she was in charge of bathing him, of dressing him, of preparing for his food. And so again, this was a very close bond that these two developed. During their lifetime, it was often people tried to assert that Matisse had fallen in love with her. Even as of a few years ago, Jacques Marie has tried to set the record straight, saying there was no love relationship between the two, but there was very much so almost this father-daughter type of relationship that they had. But in the public was having a heyday with this, trying to make something of it that was not there. When she stopped working for him after Matisse's health increased, she left him, but Matisse later contacted her and asked her if she would be willing to come back and serve as a model for her. She wasn't going to pose nude for her or anything like that, but would she be willing to come back and simply serve as a model that he could then create, create various paintings and drawings of her? So she does, and here's another one of these great quotes. She goes to Matisse, she sits for him, and he paints a picture of her, and then when she finishes, she gets to see it for the first time. And this is her response. She says, upon viewing her first portrait by Matisse called Monique, she says, when he'd finished, I looked at it and was very disappointed. It didn't look like me, and I didn't think it was very good. And I told him what I thought. He said, if I wanted something that captures reality, I'd take a photograph. That would be better than my painting. And so in this statement, you're giving an inside clue already into the chapel. What Matisse is not going to try to do when he creates various images for the chapel is to give you these real-life, naturalistic representations of objects. Why do that? I mean, if you want that, just take a photograph and then go put it in the chapel. I mean, that would be much better than anything I could ever create. And so for Matisse, his use of art isn't so much to communicate realism or naturalism, but it's to communicate to you ideas, expressions about a particular person or object, which, again, is very important for what he does. In 1946, Jacques-Marie decided to become a nun and enter the Order of the Dominicans. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, when Matisse heard these news, this was a major, major blow to him. And people realized just how upset he was, is that when he found out the news, it is said that he could not work for nearly 3 months afterwards. He couldn't get himself to do anything because of how distressed he was at the fact that she decided to join a religious order. So this, I mean, it just punched him in the stomach. Over time, however, Matisse's disappointment subsided, and he reluctantly accepted her newfound position. And what happened after he came to this acceptance, this very dynamic relationship began, where she began writing him letters and she would pose him questions about his religious beliefs. He, in turn, would then answer her. And what you find in a series of letters is, for the first time, in many ways, in Matisse's entire life, he is forced to make clear some of his religious views and beliefs. And so if this chapel never would have came into being, or if this relationship had never existed, many scholars believe that we never really would have known what Matisse's religious views or beliefs were. But they come through very powerfully in these letters. And so what I've included for you here in the notes, and I will read this, this is part of a letter written by Matisse to Sister Marie that comes in response to a letter where Sister Marie essentially makes the statement that what separates me from you is the view of the sacraments. And Matisse, in reading that, fires back at her. I mean, and he is just mad in his response. Near the end of the letter, though, after he subsides a little bit, and you can still gain a sense of some of the sarcasm, he writes this. Writes, thank you for your prayers. Ask God to give me my last years the spiritual life to keep me in touch with him and permit me to end my long and laborious career in a way that I've always sought, so that the earthly nourishment of my art may reveal his manifest glory to those who are blind to it. This for you, Jacques-Marie, is my profession of faith that comes in response to your letter. I am grateful to you for having stilled this in me. The need to answer your letter forced me to find deep within myself things I have never before expressed in words, because until now, I've never felt a need to say them to anyone. And so again, it's a very important relationship, especially the fact that you have Matisse, who is gaining a reputation not within religious circles, but within the secular art community. So again, this is important for us because it helps us to get this inside view into some of his views and beliefs. So out of this relationship between the two, in 1947, Sister Marie is going to visit with Matisse one day, and she is going to show him a drawing that she herself had created, which is the drawing actually that you see on the board here, the Assumption of the Virgin. And this is how Jacques Marie recounts what happened when she brought the drawing in. Matisse responded, "You must turn this into a window. You'll put it in your chapel." "Monsieur," replied Sister Marie, "we have no plans for a chapel." Matisse replied, "Ah, it doesn't matter. We'll design a chapel around your stained glass window." And so with that discussion, the chapel idea was born. One of the biggest arguments, not an argument, kind of a little debate between Matisse and Sister Maria's later, they will each claim that the other initially brought up the idea for the chapel. So neither of them want to claim responsibility for it. So they lob it back and forth, and so we say, generally speaking, it was through this conversation that the chapel is born. In December 1949, the cornerstone of the chapel was laid, and then 3 years later, on June 25th, 1951, the chapel was inaugurated and consecrated. Upon completion of the chapel, Matisse wrote these words. He wrote, "This work required me 4 years of an exclusive and untiring effort, and it is the fruit of my whole working life." Again, just an insight of what he really thought of this. But another one of these great little stories that came out of this is that for those of you who might be familiar with Matisse, historically, there's a very interesting relationship between Matisse and Pablo Picasso. Not only were they two modern artists who were seen as being leaders in the field, but they had a very interesting relationship where they were friends to one another, but they were also rivals, and they were constantly trying to outdo the other in the work that they would create. And when Pablo Picasso found out that Matisse was going to do a chapel, a religious work of art, he not only rejected it, but just fired back at Matisse. In a sense, how can you do this? And part of this whole movement of early modernism is, aren't we supposed to be separating ourselves from the church? And aren't we supposed to be countering it? What are you doing making a chapel? Where's it coming from? And so as Matisse himself recounts the event, this is how the conversation unraveled. Picasso asked, and this is part of Picasso's questioning to Matisse, "Do I believe in God?" And notice his response. "Yes, when I work. I feel like I am assisted by someone who leads me to do things that are greater than myself, greater than what I've done before." Picasso was furious that I was doing a church. "Why don't you do a market?" he asked. "You could paint fruit, vegetables. I could accept it if you were a believer, but if you are not, I do not think you have the moral right to do a chapel." I replied that for me, doing this is essentially a work of art. I don't know whether or not I am a believer. The essential is to work in a state of mind that is close to prayer. And so again, through these discussions that erupted while he was doing the chapel, again, gives us some of our best insights into where exactly was Matisse spiritually? What were his beliefs? Unfortunately, I think many of his statements leave you more confused than when you actually begin. But again, it's through this process that we receive this information. So with this background in mind, what I would then like to do is to move into the chapel itself. And if you look at the chapel as a whole, again, this is a large space where Matisse created everything in it, but there are essentially two objects that really have captured the attention of a lot of the scholars and in terms of the writing. And that is, first you have a series of stained glass windows that Matisse created, and then you have three monumental ceramic line drawings. Matisse, in writing about the chapel, states that in the chapel, my overarching goal is to balance a surface of light and color with a white wall covered with drawings in black. And so even for Matisse, the stained glass windows and the drawings, I mean, those were a focus for him. And part of how the chapel works in his mind is that as the light streams in through the sun to the stained glass windows, that colorful light is reflected on a white surface. And so that white surface then is transformed into a color surface. However, depending on the position of the sun and the time of day when the light shines in, while the light in the stained glass windows will always remain the same, the light reflected on the white walls will change. And so you have a static room that is constantly changing before your eyes. And it's changing through this play of color. An interesting note that has been made about the stained glass window, if you notice, it hangs like a curtain. And so there's this idea of a drama that's going on. You're watching this divine drama as the light pours in to the chapel. And the somewhat odd-looking yellow objects are actually based on a regional cactus that he enjoyed. And there's yellow flowers that grow on the cactus, and so they became the inspiration to create these abstract shapes. But what I would like to do more specifically is to focus our attention and spend a little bit of time talking about his monumental ceramic line drawings. And again, there are three of these drawings that he created. He created one of Saint Dominic on the left, and then you have an image of Mary and Jesus in the middle, and then you have what is by far one of the most controversial works of art ever to be placed into a church, his Stations of the Cross. I mean, that was the biggie. Now, why did he choose these subjects? Well, here's how he lays it out. He chose St. Dominic because the sisters were of the Dominicans. So he was creating a chapel for the Dominican order. Thus, you would naturally represent him. You would represent Mary and the Christ child because the sisters were of the order of Our Mother of the Rosary. Thus, he decided that because of who they were, he would include that. And the Stations of the Cross, he said, I included those simply because, well, they're always in a chapel. They're always within a Catholic setting. And so it's only natural to include these objects. To create the drawings, Matisse used a 9-foot pole with a rag attached to the end dipped in glaze. Now, this isn't obviously the 9-foot pole, but here you have Matisse. He's sitting in his wheelchair, and you get a sense, because of the fact of how he was bound to his chair, of how he would paint. So you have him holding, you know, a brush that was maybe 3 feet long with some paint on the end. But there are these pictures that you can find of Matisse painting in the chapel, I mean, holding this 9-foot pole with a small rag on the end from the ground, painting these particular objects. And so, again, how he did this is very interesting. Matisse used to say that in order for him to draw something and really capture, or to know that he captured the essence of it, he would have to draw it with his eyes closed until he felt that he got it. And so when he drew Saint Dominic, for example, he drew him over and over and over and over and over again with his eyes closed. And then as soon as he felt that he got it, then he would go in and paint the original. So he did this for much of the work that he created. Now, one of the reasons Matisse gave as to why he used such simplistic lines for his drawings, there's a very specific reason behind this. And the reason deals with that for Matisse, the drawings were seen as the visual equivalent to a large open book where the white tiles are the pages and the black lines are the words. So when, in comparison now, if you refer back to Grunewald's crucifixion painting, here you have in Grunewald the inclusion of a literal text with literal words that are designed to be read visually as you looked at the painting. In Matisse, you have the same concept, but for Matisse, it's purely symbolic. And so when you look at his line drawings, while you appreciate them as drawings, again, keep in mind how he's thinking of this is that I'm presenting a text to you. Here are the pages, and here is the black print or the words that you would read upon them. So we find this other connection between the two images. All of this brings us to his Stations of the Cross. Again, arguably the most controversial features in the chapel. And what you'll notice, if you take all three of the monumental drawings and you compare them together, you'll notice that the image of Saint Dominic and the image of Mary and the child are drawn in a very similar manner. They have very clean, very straight lines. It looks like he took his time. It's very clear. And you then look at the Stations of the Cross, and there is this marked difference. They look much more jagged. They look more scribbled than some of his other drawings in the chapel. And so a lot of question came up about, well, what are you doing with those line drawings? And here comes Sister Marie. Now, up until this point, Sister Marie knew that Matisse was going to be producing a Stations of the Cross. What she had seen is that up until Matisse actually painted it, he had created a series of drawings, preparatory drawings, and the drawings themselves, they're not representational, but they're very detailed in comparison. And so she had seen these drawings time and time again, and so in her mind, this is what it's going to look like. So she's expecting one thing, and then she walks into the chapel, and she sees the finished work for the first time. And in her honesty, this is how she describes it. She says, I felt like I had been kicked in the stomach. I stared at what I was tempted to call scribble. I looked at these drawings and thought, how am I going to get my sisters to accept this? That was my real concern. The chapel itself was a problem. Again, just the controversy around it. The stations were going to be really hard to swallow. What bothered me was the total simplicity of the drawings. His early sketches were much more developed, more realistic. Here, there were just lines. What are you doing? What did you do here? Well, this raises a very interesting question with regards to both Matisse and Christian art in general, and it's kind of a leap-off point. But if you interpret these drawings based on how they represent natural things in real life, beyond a shadow of a doubt, you could say that these are some of the worst drawings ever produced by a noteworthy artist. If that's how you judge them, if that's your starting point, then they would instantly receive a failing grade. However, if you look at these images and you interpret them as symbols, as Matisse designed or intended them to be seen, not only do you better understand what he's trying to do, but inadvertently, Matisse is taking you back to the days of the early church. And these little simple lines that you see in Matisse, you find those same sort of images in the catacombs. And it raises this whole discussion and brings forth this idea of this use of visual symbols in the church. And so Matisse, while he is modern in what he is doing, he's also a doorway that is taking you back to the catacombs. And he's connecting you to the earliest tradition of Christian symbolism. And so what I'd like to do for the next few moments is to kind of jump back a little bit and to talk about this use of symbolism in the church. Because this is really where I was hoping to go with Matisse. To give you a basic definition, then, of symbolism, we could say that a visual symbol is simply a material object used to represent something, often immaterial. Throughout the history of the church, the primary use of symbols was to instruct and encourage believers. But this is where the power of symbolism comes in, though, is that what a symbol does is it takes an everyday object that we see all around us, and by attaching a spiritual meaning to it, what was once an ordinary object now becomes an opportunity for theological reflection. The more you interpret the world symbolically through this lens, what you discover is that within your daily existence, virtually everything around you suddenly becomes a prompt for theological reflection. And so the power of symbolism is that it takes the ordinary and transforms it into the extraordinary, the extraordinary. If we were to go back to the early church, some of the earliest Christian symbols that we used, for example, included the peacock, which was a symbol of heaven, primarily because of the beautiful array of the colors in the wings. The anchor was a symbol of hope. And actually, the anchor, we believe, is possibly the oldest Christian symbol that we have. Predates the cross by at least two centuries. The fish, very familiar, served as a symbol of Christian baptism, a symbol of evangelism. The idea of making fishers of men was attached to the symbol. And then, as we all know, the acrostic ichthus, in terms of representing actually Jesus himself, that ichthus could serve as a soteriological statement that could not only be reduced to the letters of the word fish, but could be further reduced to a simple visual symbol comprised of two lines. The symbol of the fish is often, it's a very interesting one to explore historically, because one of the uses we think that the church made of the fish is that if you were in public and you were living at a time when there was persecution and you met someone and you were trying to find out if they were a believer or not, but you didn't want to come out and say it because if you said it, people around might hear you, that what you might do is while you were walking and talking with this person, you might stop and take your foot and you would draw half of a curve in the dirt. And if the believer, if it was a believer, and he would have been aware of this, he would complete the fish design with his foot. And so by making these two simple lines, you would make the fish symbol in the dirt, and right there you knew that there was this connection. And so the symbol is very, very powerful in how it was used. And then obviously one of the most, I mean today, most endearing symbols was the symbol of the cross. However, the symbol of the cross will not actually emerge until well into the 4th century. So in terms of symbols, the cross is rather late in coming. But it quickly became seen as an overall symbol of redemption and salvation. During the great age of Christian symbolism in the West, essentially was during the Middle Ages, and we believe that it peaked somewhere around the time of the 15th century, or during the time of the early Renaissance. And to give you an example of how powerful symbolism was for the church, I want to walk you through a little bit a painting that was done by Fra Angelico titled The Annunciation that was created, again, around 1434. So again, at the peak of, as the church is using symbols to try to communicate theological knowledge, Fra Angelico paints this painting, and from the surface, we would say, well, given the title, etc., that, yeah, this is a painting that is simply trying to communicate to you the event in the Gospels where you have the angel Gabriel, the angel appears to Mary and informs her that she will be with child. So on the surface, that seems like, okay, yeah, that's pretty self-explanatory. However, if you start to walk your way through the symbols, what you realize is that the event of the angel coming to Mary, that's only a very, very small part of what this painting is really trying to hit home to the viewer. And so to walk through this a little bit, one of the first things that you need to know and take notice of is where you as the viewer are placed in the painting. What I mean by that is that here you have this event of the angel and Mary, but instead of placing you right in the middle of it, the artist sets you slightly off to the side. And so while he clearly calls attention to that event, you're able to see two events that are happening simultaneously. You have the New Testament event of the angel and Mary, but then to the left, you have the Old Testament event of Adam and Eve being expelled from the garden. So you, from the beginning, you are meant to see both of these things. Although you, because of the size of Mary, we often miss that detail, but that is no small detail because that's part of the clue to the larger meaning of this piece. So if we were to start then with the angel Gabriel and focus in on him, what you'll notice is that you have the angel. He is walking in from the outside. And so the assumption is that here you have Mary. She's sitting in her room, and this is the moment when the angel appears to her. We have the angel who is speaking words to her. So like Grunewald, here again you have biblical text that is written, that's painted into the image. And so if you were to read the text, which you could physically do if you saw a good image of the original, the angel is speaking, "The Holy Spirit has come upon thee, and the power of the Highest shall overshadow thee." With his left hand then, he is issuing the pronouncement to Mary. And then with his right hand, he is pointing to Mary to make sure that she realizes that she is the recipient of what he is saying. So just in the same way that you have Grunewald and the use of the hands and pointing to make sure that you as a viewer, you're not missing anything, we find the same thing happening here. So the angel is pointing to Mary. The colorful wings of the angels ties back to the symbol of the peacock. And so the colorfulness of it is a symbol that shows the closeness of the proximity of the angel to God himself. The closer, because the angel is closer to God than Mary, he is more colorful by design. And that's why when you see these angel wings, and they always, I mean, just look exploded with color and it's so beautiful. Well, that's the reason. You're tying it into this peacock idea. Just a note of interest, the hem design around the bottom of the angel is actually based on Ming porcelain. And there's a very popular oriental design. And so here you have Fra Angelico, who he's pulling these different elements from these different cultures as he's reworking this. So we then come to Mary, and one of the first things we note is that her hands, in the same way as the Grunewald painting, they tell the story. And what you notice about her hands is they're crossed and they're open, and that openness is a symbol communicating that she is willing to receive the message that is coming to her. So she not only hears the angel, but she's saying, yes, let God's will be done. I am open to this. She as well responds, and she speaks to the angel Unfortunately, the text of Mary's response is written in the painting, but it's rather faint. But what's fascinating about her response is that unlike the angels, where you can read it physically, Mary's response is turned upside down. So the only one who can read it is God. He's the only viewer of that event. She's responding to him, not to you. And so you know she responds, but you are not given the privilege to enter into that conversation. And so she responds by saying, "Behold, the handmaiden of the Lord, be it unto me according to thy word." Another note, or another important symbol, is that if you look in the background, what you're looking into in the room, if you see where the red curtain is, that's a doorway that leads into Mary's bedroom. And the curtain that is pulled is a symbol of Mary's virginity. And so you have this symbol that's, again, emphasizing the point that at the time of when she is visited by angels, she is a virgin, that her virginity is in place. The dove, then, becomes a symbol of the Holy Spirit. But notice what's on her lap. There is a text on Mary's lap, and the text is open. And the text is open to a very specific passage of Scripture. And the Scripture, again, if you could see the original, you could read what it says. The text that she is reading is Isaiah 7:14. "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child, and he will give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel." So here is Mary. She's in her room. She is reading Isaiah. She's reading about this Old Testament prophecy. While she is reading the prophecy, the angel comes in, makes this proclamation, and essentially says, what you are reading about in Isaiah, you are the fulfillment of that prophecy. So what you're reading, you are now going to fulfill that. Why this is so important is that when you look at the Corinthian pillar in the middle, and you go to the top above the Capitol, there is an architectural detail of a man who is sitting up there. That man is a carving of the prophet Isaiah. And the text of Isaiah 7:14 is on his scroll. And so you have Isaiah witnessing the fulfillment of his biblical prophecy. So not only is it being fulfilled, but the Old Testament witness himself is watching this event unfold. The dove, very common symbol of the Holy Spirit, but notice where the dove is. It has not yet fully descended upon Mary. So what you have here, again, let me make a reference back to Grunewald. You have a static image that is trying to come alive with its action because you are watching a scene that is unfolding before your eyes. This isn't an over and said event. You are watching this happen. Mary's reading, the angel comes in, the Holy Spirit's coming down, Isaiah is witnessing this, the fulfillment's about to happen, but not yet. And there's a reason why it hasn't quite yet happened, but is about to happen. And where that reason comes from is the Old Testament reference to Adam and Eve. And so again, here you are as a viewer, you're witnessing this scene that is unfolding before your eyes, and while you are watching the dove almost ascend upon Mary and bring this prophecy into fulfillment, at the same time, you're watching another event in the process of happening take place out of the corner of your eye. And so again, what you're drawn to in this other account is that of Adam and Eve. Notice you are not watching Adam and Eve in the process of sinning. It's not Adam and Eve taking the apple. It's not God creating Adam. I mean, you are watching them as they are in the act of being expelled. In other words, they are now experiencing the dramatic consequences of their sin. They are outside of the garden. They are pushed out and notice the setting into which they are going. It's barren, it's rocky, it's dirt, there's not much greenery there. The scene of Adam and Eve is separated from the scene of Mary by a fence. And that fence is there by no accident, because the fence is there to remind you of this separation. This is an event that is happening back there. So you have Adam and Eve, they're being expelled, in contrast to the hands of Mary and the angel, which are very expressive, one emphasizing the message is coming to you, Mary saying, be it done to me according to your will. If you could, again, see a very good reproduction of Adam and Eve, their hands are almost contrived to be the pinnacle of grief and despair. So their hands are the complete opposite of Mary, in other words. I mean, they're visually very contrastive. And so when you take all of these things together, what you realize is that the painting, while the whole event of the Annunciation is part of it, the painting represents both the fall of humanity and the promise of salvation. Thus, it is a reflection on the broader subject of salvation as well as the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And so what you have in front of you, some would say, I mean, this is a sermon in paint, as some of these images will be called during the Reformation. And so it's not just a single idea, but it is this entire soteriological concept of salvation. And that as Adam and Eve, they've sinned. The moment they stepped foot out of the garden, God is coming down with the solution to the problem. It's happening almost instantaneously. And so again, you as the viewer are watching both of these events unfold before your eyes. This is just one example of paintings from this period. And you could spend from now for the next 5-6 years just working through the symbolism of Fra Angelico. I mean, these paintings are absolutely loaded with meaning. But it's not just him. It's the art of that entire period that is doing this. And so it serves for us, I mean, today, a very interesting example of how the church sought to use symbolism in such a way that it helped to bring out deeper theological meanings within various worship contexts. That by including a few simple objects or colors or even lines, you could present this message that would speak volumes to its audience. It makes these paintings very fun to talk about because you can do this with almost everyone. And it's just like unpacking a story. For me, or actually, one other note, is that the challenge here of using symbolism is that it requires a great deal of knowledge on the part of the viewer. Some have said this is why symbolism has died for the most part in the church today. That where there is a general biblical and theological illiteracy among congregations, symbolism will never be able to have its full impact. Because what makes symbolism powerful and useful for instructing and encouraging believers is that you have to do it in a context where the viewers are aware of all of the meanings and associations. For the early church, where there was this deep common knowledge, that's part of the reason as to why these symbols flourished, because of this common knowledge. In his book, The Elements of Christian Symbolism, John Baldock notes that the more Western society has moved towards materialism, the more it has eroded and continues to erode the use of symbolism in the Christian church. And so to somewhat wind this lecture down, I thought I would just make a couple notes that for me, this whole subject of symbolism hits very deep at home. In addition to teaching, I'm also a visual artist. I've been doing this for many, many years, and one of my main focus points as a visual artist has been the reinterpretation of traditional Christian symbols into modern worship context. And so what I have found is that just in my own work, you know, that the more I've studied symbolism and the more that you learn to look at these ordinary objects and find this deeper theological meaning that's attached to it, you cannot look at the world the same around you ever again. Because almost anything and everything you see, when you begin to attach these meanings, becomes an opportunity for theological reflection and for personal worship. I didn't know if I was going to share this. Maybe I will share this. Might seem kind of odd. But to give an example of how, for me, symbolism works in my daily life as a believer, this was something that I started doing, I think, 8 or 9 years ago. I'm not quite sure where exactly the idea for it came up with. But I'm a very visually orientated person, and so I'm very attuned to physical objects. And so what I do is each morning when I wake up, as I sit down to pray, as part of my prayer time, I'll take a single round wheat cracker. And for me, the wheat cracker is a symbol of anything that could happen to me that day. It's my day today. It was reflected back in a cracker that I ate this morning. I then take the cracker, I spread half of it with honey and half of it with horseradish. The honey represents anything and everything good that could possibly happen to me today. And the horseradish represents anything and everything possibly bad that could happen to me today. And so as I pray, I eat it. And what you find out is that when you eat sweet honey and sour horseradish, you cry. And you have this very odd experience of sweetness and nasty and sweetness and nasty. But as I eat it, it reminds me that regardless of what happens to me today, Lord, I pray that I will respond in a way that is consistent throughout and that brings you glory and honor in and through it all. And so for me, again, I've been doing this almost every day for many, many years. So some people, I mean, it's good to give you the context because some will hear, say, well, you eat crackers and horseradish? What are you doing? And I'll say, well, it's kind of a long story, but that's the meaning. And so for me, when it comes to Henri Matisse, he serves as a constant reminder of how, again, the church has used symbolism in the past and challenges me to think, how can I seek to bring and to rethink this use of symbolism and possibly incorporate it into a worship context in a way that could possibly allow for greater opportunities for people to engage and have not only more frequent moments of theological reflection, but to be able to draw them deeper into theological dialogues. And so with that, I come to the end of both of the lectures.